Still, just 6% of parliamentarians are from the working class. Yael Braun-Pivet was elected speaker, the first woman to hold the post, and another relatively unknown politician from Macron's party. France is the second-to-last country in the European Union to have a woman head a House of Parliament. By denying Macron a majority, French Parliament is poised to play a bigger role than at any time in the 21st century. However, they face an executive branch which has repeatedly found ways to either sideline or bypass them. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Islamophobic abuse is something most Muslims living in Britain have to deal with, but many were shocked to discover just how dangerous the problem has become. After shocking statistics have been revealed which show a large number of British mosques have become regular targets of hate crime. According to survey data gathered by the Muslim Engagement and Development Group, also known as MEND, and in cooperation with Muslim Census, 42% of mosques and Islamic institutions have faced attacks in the past 3 years, and 35% experienced a religiously motivated attack at least once a year, with racial and religious aggravated offences increasing 15% since last year. In a statement, the government reaffirmed its earlier pledge to provide greater funding for mosque security.
We take a zero-tolerance approach to all forms of hate crime, and we're committed to rooting it out wherever it exists. In addition to funding for projects and organizations which promote diversity and tolerance, we're taking steps to safeguard places of worship with a grant of over £24.5 million available this year.
But a spokesperson from Muslim Census claimed that the government isn't doing enough to tackle the issue.
The Home Office publishes a report every year on the distribution of religious hate crimes, and almost half are experienced by Muslims in this country. Now we've got places of worship included as well. Almost half of the mosques experience some form of religious attack as well. And it is a cause for concern. It is super alarming. And as a Muslim, you think, when will I experience something similar?
The most common form of attack is vandalism, followed by theft. However, many Islamic institutions have expressed deep fear that future attackers may resort to targeting innocent people as opposed to just property, as was the case outside Finsbury Park Mosque during a deadly terrorist attack targeting the establishment in 2017. Robert Carter, London.
At the conclusion of an official visit to Syria, an Iranian media delegation headed by Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting chief Peyman Jibili met with Syria's Minister of Culture. Jibili congratulated Syria for its victory on terror, asserting terrorism failed to destroy Syria's thousands of years old culture and civilization. He expressed readiness to launch joint projects with Syria in the media and cinema fields.
We discussed topics of mutual interest, such as producing joint movies and cultural documentaries. We also agreed to support joint cultural activities in both countries, like festivals. We hope such visits constitute a starting point for cultural exchange between the two brotherly peoples, because the will of leaderships of both states is to reach the highest level of cooperation.
Syrian Minister of Culture Lubana Mshawah said the war on Syria was aimed at extinguishing its national will and identity, but failed. She expressed Syria's willingness to set up work mechanisms for activating an exchange of expertise between both countries, as well as promoting Syria's culture in Iran and vice versa.
We discussed all details of our cultural cooperation, which would increase to match the level of our political relations. We want the two countries' people to know each other better, and culture is the perfect gate fair for that. We ask Iran to play a role in training Syrian cadres in the cinema industry, and we hope to see soon Iranian artists performing at Al-Asad House for art and culture.
The delegation wrapped up the two-day visit, which included meetings with Syria's Prime Minister and Minister of Information. Stress was laid basically on increasing collaboration and joint action to create a stronger frontline against media campaigns that want to mislead the public opinion on the truth of events in the region. Discussions focused on building up stronger relations in various sectors. Officials agreed to step up cooperation between Syrian and Iranian media outlets in an effort to counter Western propaganda against countries that support resistance. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
After years of war and blockade on Yemen, and just as hopes were being raised that the humanitarian situation will improve thanks to the UN brokered truce, the World Food Programme has announced that it is suspending humanitarian work in the country since the beginning of June. The body says it is short on funding and that obstacles to food supply due to war in Ukraine are making things worse.
There is no doubt that the decision of the World Food Programme to suspend its activities in Yemen is catastrophic and surprising. The World Food Programme announced earlier this year that it will be cutting off on humanitarian aid for Yemen due to lack of funding. The suspension of humanitarian activities is a totally different story and has major repercussions, as Yemen is facing what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Unfortunately, the UN and its food assistance programme link humanitarian aid to political and military issues.
The program now says that the Yemen humanitarian response plan for 2022 is 74% underfunded, which means the program requires $1.5 billion in funding.
What the media reported, that the World Food Program will suspend its activities in Yemen, will lead to a humanitarian catastrophe with unimaginable consequences. We hold the United Nations fully responsible for the repercussions of halting humanitarian aid, as Yemen is in a phase of famine.
Saudi Arabia began its war in Yemen in March 2015 and has imposed a siege on the country ever since. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine, where almost 80% of the population depends on humanitarian aid to survive.
After all the hard work put into reaching the current truce and extending it, suspension of humanitarian aid could also undermine the political process. The United Nations should now double its efforts and change its strategies to help Yemenis in dire need of aid. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Unlawful and unfair. This is how experts refer to Sweden's trial of Hamid Nouri, a former Iranian judiciary official who has been in detention in Sweden for the past 2 years over alleged prisoner abuse in 1988. Here in Iran, this group of law experts have gathered to examine the rights violations Sweden has committed against Hamid Nouri for charging him without solid evidence.
None of those who testified against Mr. Nouri were eyewitnesses. They have never been in touch with him. So Stockholm's court should have not involved itself in false accusations leveled against Mr. Nouri by a terrorist entity. The Swedish justice system is violating international law by interfering in another country's judicial system.
The suit was lodged by members of the Mujahideen Khalq organization, or shortly MKO, a formidable terror group responsible for most of the assassinations that have targeted Iranian people and officials since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The terror group claims that Nouri was involved in the execution and torture of its members in 1988. The Swedish prosecutor has charged Nouri with war crimes and crimes against humanity, something which the ex-Iranian official dismisses as imaginary. These people say MKO itself has committed countless war crimes with impunity.
MKO terrorists have the blood of some 17,000 Iranians on their hands. They assisted former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in his 8-year war against Iran. They have committed thousands of war crimes and must be punished by the international legal systems. Yet we see that Sweden simply ignores the MKO crimes and instead accuses a retired Iranian judicial clerk of war crimes.
Swedish prosecutors have now requested the maximum penalty of life imprisonment for Hamid Nouri. The final verdict is scheduled to be handed down to Nouri on July 14th.
It seems that the entire case is a political campaign aimed at smearing the Islamic Republic's judicial system. I think if the Swedish judiciary pursues righteousness, it will vindicate Mr. Nouri of all the charges.
Hamid Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Sweden at Stockholm Airport in 2019 and was immediately imprisoned. Nouri, now 61, has been held in solitary confinement for over 2 years now.
Experts here say Sweden's trial of Hamid Nouri follows baseless allegations made by a terrorist organization, and therefore it has no legal grounds. They asked Sweden to immediately release the Iranian national. Otherwise, they say, it could be construed that the Swedish judicial system is swayed by the MKO terror group. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A six-year-old girl lies in her coffin. Her name is Alina. She was killed by Ukrainian army shelling of the Donetsk region. Her family and the local community mourn together. As she's taken away to the burial site, her grandmother bids farewell to her beloved granddaughter for the last time. She asks for forgiveness. Now, Alina was killed. Speaking to locals and the family, they tell me that she was killed because of a Ukrainian shell that was fired in this direction, and an anti-air defense missile fired by the Russians hit that missile in the mid-air, and shrapnel showered to the ground to kill Alina. There was the massive boom of the anti-air defense working. Alina didn't die straight away. She was taken to hospital and died 2 days later. The clock is stopped at 6:12, the moment Alina's heart stopped beating. She arrives at the burial site. Her family say their final goodbyes. Now, there's something particularly shocking about a child killed in war. Few people here can hold back the tears. While millions of people in NATO countries continue to encourage their governments to send more weapons to Ukraine instead of negotiating for peace, the fact of the matter is, the longer this war goes on, the more children like Alina will be killed. A memorial in Donetsk. The sign reads, "To the children killed in Donbass since 2014. There is no end date, as children continue to die. Mourners take their turn to pay their final respects. For 8 years, Ukraine has targeted and killed civilians here in Donetsk. President Zelensky, lionized in the West for defending European values, has continued the policy. Alina's whole life was lived during this war, a war now escalated by the Russian invasion and NATO's policy of arming Ukraine instead of pushing for negotiations. This is the true reality of war." Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
To the southeast of the Prophet's Mosque in Medina exists a cemetery that is the most famous and holiest in the Islamic world, Jannatul Baqi, meaning the Garden of Heaven. After the dawn prayers, the gates of Baqi are opened for a few hours, and crowds of Muslim pilgrims flock to it. Baqi is the main burial ground for the people of Medina since the time of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and contains graves of many of the Prophet Muhammad's family and companions.
In order to describe the importance of Baqi Cemetery, I have to say it is a rendezvous of thousands of Muslims every day.
Baqi is honored to host the tombs of four infallible Imams, Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba, Imam Ali Zain al-Abidin, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, peace be upon them. Today, there is no trace of the shrine that used to contain their tombs. Close to the graves are the remains of the House of Sorrows, a place where the Prophet's daughter, Lady Fatima, used to come to and shed tears of grief over the loss of her father.
When you enter in Mazari Baqiya, when you enter Mantwari Baqiya, there you become very, you know, emotional.
It is also believed that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, often prayed in Baqi whenever he was passing through.
Baqi is like no other cemetery in the world of Islam. It's a place of absolute sanctity for all Muslims. Therefore, Hajj pilgrims every year visit this place to pay tribute to the relatives and companions of the Holy Prophet. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
It takes an in-person visit to Iran by the EU foreign policy chief now to revitalize the ailing 2015 deal between Iran and world powers. Josep Borrell said his two-day trip to Tehran is aimed at removing the last remaining roadblocks to concluding the Vienna talks, which have been at a stalemate since March this year.
My visit has one main objective. It was to break the current dynamic of escalation and to break the stalemate of the negotiations on the JCPOA.
The talks in Vienna began in April last year with the aim of returning the United States to the 2015 deal and ensuring Tehran's full compliance with its commitments. The negotiations have been stalled since March amid differences between Tehran and Washington. Iran says the United States, which is not directly engaged in the talks, must remove all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance with the accord.
We hope that the Americans will this time be realistic and act responsibly on the path toward achieving an agreement.
Borrell says it's in no one's interest that the pause in the talks persists, urging Tehran and Washington to resume the talks as soon as possible.
There are decisions that have to be taken in Tehran and in Washington. But we agreed today that this visit will be followed by the resumption of negotiations also between Iran and U.S., facilitated by my team to try to solve the last outstanding issues.
Iran welcomed Borrell's call. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says his country is ready to resume the talks within the next few days.
First of all, Iran is ready to get back to the talks in the coming days. Secondly, what is important for the Islamic Republic is that Iran should enjoy the economic benefits promised under the agreement that was signed in 2015.
Iran started to scale back its obligations to the 2015 deal following Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the accord in 2018 and its ensuing imposition of sanctions on Iran. That triggered a series of talks between Iran and the remaining parties to the deal in Vienna to salvage the accord.
The Vienna discussions have for months been in limbo as a result of serious demands that neither sides of the bargain are willing to give up on. However, Borrell sees a glimmer of hope at the end of the tunnel, promising to help Tehran and Washington sort out the last remaining issues when the talks will resume in the upcoming days. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing, who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely, thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
It's called the New Force Model by NATO, in which it says it is a new strategic concept, one that describes Russia as the most significant and direct threat to allies' security and stability. Now we ask, what is so new about that? Meanwhile, Russia has reacted and has accused the U.S.-led NATO of aggressive containment of Russia. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll review the NATO summit's communique, which also includes how it has described China of being a threat to the world order.
Leaders of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization gathered for their annual summit in the Spanish capital, Madrid. As expected, this year's summit turned into an anti-Russia agenda in the wake of growing tensions between Moscow and the West over the Ukraine war that began in February.
President Putin's war against Ukraine has shattered peace in Europe and has created the biggest security crisis in Europe since the Second World War.
The Western Military Alliance also pledged to ramp up military support for Ukraine.
And today, leaders agreed to strengthen our support by agreeing a comprehensive assistance package for Ukraine. This includes equipment to counter mines and chemical and biological threats, and hundreds of portable anti-drone systems.
Western countries, including the United States, have provided Kyiv with billions of dollars worth of weapons since the war began. Russia sees it as the main factor behind prolonging the conflict.
It seems to us that the kind of line that the West has taken is absolutely counterproductive and harmful. The more they pump weapons into Ukraine, the longer this conflict will last.
Irrespective of huge military support for Ukraine, NATO's ambitious plan for expanding its membership has also driven a wedge between the alliance and Russia. However, NATO leaders have welcomed Finland and Sweden into the alliance after Turkey struck a deal with the Nordic duo to drop its objections.
Today, NATO leaders took the historic decision to invite Finland and Sweden to become members of NATO. The agreement concluded last night by Turkey, Finland and Sweden paved the way for this decision.
Russia says the two countries' accession to NATO is destabilizing.
We consider the expansion of the North Atlantic Alliance to be a purely destabilizing factor in international affairs. It does not add security either to those who are expanding it, those joining it, or to other countries that perceive the alliance as a threat.
The rift between Russia and the West has raised concerns that the ongoing war in Ukraine could escalate into a nuclear conflict, the fallout of which could deal devastating blows to the world.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight. Daniel Kovalik, an international human rights and labor lawyer, joins us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is Kent Stone, from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, who joins us from Hamilton, Ontario. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ken Sonnen, we first start with you. What do you think about the name New Force Model, which NATO describes as a new strategic blueprint in which the U.S.-led NATO is referring to Russia based on this as a direct threat to the security of the member states? And then my question to you is, what is so new about this? And even if it's true, who provoked this sentiment for Russia to become, as they perceive, a security threat?
Well, it's not new at all. As a matter of fact, when Lester B. Pearson, who was Foreign Minister of Canada, proposed the formation of NATO before 1949, his view was to bring down socialism in the former Soviet Union and to actually bring down the Soviet Union. So NATO has been a threat, an existential threat to Russia for 70 years. And once the Soviet Union dissolved itself, rather than dissolving NATO, which was supposed to be dealing with a supposed Russian threat, NATO went on the warpath and showed its true colors. It is the aggressive military alliance led by the United States, which promptly in the 1990s went against the former Yugoslavian Federation. It attacked it, bombed it for 78 days, and destroyed it, and swallowed up its component parts. Then it went after Afghanistan, and then it went after Iraq, and then it went after Libya. So the U.S. Has NATO in its pocket as an aggressive military alliance. The U.S., in the when the Soviet Union dissolved itself, wanted to become a the only superpower in a unipolar world, and that's what they're trying to do today in Madrid. They are saying that Russia is the enemy, and Russia does not want to be seen as its enemy.
Okay.
So it. Okay.
Okay. You make some good points there. I'd like to, however, move on to this timeline, Daniel Kobalik, which was highlighted just a few weeks back, and that is the fact that this war passed 100 days. And that was obviously a very grim milestone in a sense. But in reality, this war has been going on now for 8 years, hasn't it? And if you want to even go further than that, we can, because Russia has been seeing NATO's eastward expansion for all this time, hasn't it? It's been provoked, whether directly by NATO and its moves, but even more so maybe by the U.S. in terms of the way that it has treated Russia in terms of sanctions, in terms of just making it and a national security threat based on the way that the U.S. sees it. So is it a surprise that Russia has acted out the way that it did? Again, I need to make a note here that we are not for war. We're not advocating war by this question. But, you know, when you push somebody so much for such a length of time, then my question to you is it a surprise that Russia has acted out?
No, and I've written about this. I mean, first of all, I've been writing about this for years, that this was a risk, that eventually Russia probably would react the way they did because of, as you say, NATO expansion that really began in earnest under William Jefferson Clinton, even after numerous promises were made by James Baker and others that NATO would not move an inch east of Germany if the Berlin Wall came down, which it did, but the U.S. and NATO never upheld their part of that bargain. And you mentioned, of course, in 2014, the coup against the government in Ukraine, which the U.S. was behind, and the U.S.-backed ultra-right-wing forces that very quickly made it clear that they wanted to ethnically cleanse the Russian, ethnic Russian population from the eastern part of Ukraine. We see the New York Times in the past week has said what a lot of us have known for a while, that the CIA's been operating in Ukraine for some time, training and giving logistical support to armed forces that target Russians in Ukraine. So really what's happened in Madrid is simply an announcement of a position of a strategy that's existed for a long time, which has been the dismantling of Russia. I think that, you know, in the light of day now, as the years have passed, we can now honestly and truthfully say that the Cold War never really ended, that the Russians fully expected it would end with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the East Bloc in 1991. But for the West, it never ended, that was not enough, that it wasn't just about communism. It was about Russia as well. And it was about China as well as potential adversaries. And now we know this. And now NATO is being very clear that their intention is to drive Russia into the ground.
Well, Kent Stone, when you take a look, I referred to a timeline there to Daniel Kobalik. When you take a look at the length of this war, the way that the U.S. has approached it in particular, and then you take a look at what has happened in this summit, where NATO felt that there needs to be a new rejuvenate this anti-Russia sentiment in a new form. It's almost like it's being reintroduced. Is there a possibility that they're doing that because they want to make sure that the threat or the perceived threat of Russia still exists among member states led by the U.S., which is ramping up, in a sense, scaremongering, so that that remains and people or the countries don't falter from that course?
Well, it's clear to me and to people in the peace movement that what NATO is doing in Ukraine is to march NATO up to the borders of Russia, of the Russian Federation, and do to Russia what it did to the former Yugoslavia. That is to say, to defeat it militarily and then to dismember it, the better to gobble it up. It's part of the U.S. plan, with the help of its military alliance, NATO, to achieve hegemony over the entire world. After they supposedly get the defeat of Russia, the dismemberment of the Russian Federation, then they will move on to China. That's the plan. And it should be clear to everyone in the world. It's clear to us here in the peace movement, and it's clear to people who are demonstrating in Madrid today and having counter summits, and it's clear to the workers who are in Spain and Greece and other countries who are preventing supplies, military equipment of NATO going to Ukraine, that the NATO has, and U.S. of course, has a warlike agenda. Their plans to expand their strike force, to label Russia as an adversary, and to label China as a threat is clearly antagonistic to our desire to have a peaceful world where all countries are their sovereignty is treated with respect. But that's not the case with NATO. When the U.S. decides that it wants to force a country to yield its energy resources, as in the case of Libya, or its strategic position in the case of Afghanistan, it unleashes NATO upon that country and creates havoc. It destroys whole countries and turns their population into refugees. And this is what we've seen over and over again in the past 30 years. And yes, the U.S. is trying to marshal its European vassals, and I say vassals because they can be herded, even though it's like herding cats. They can be herded and turned against an alleged enemy of the U.S. on the snap of its fingers, and they can even be persuaded to impose sanctions which cripple themselves rather than the supposed target. Right. There's going to be terrible results in Europe and North America as a result of the sanctions that have been leveled against Russia. And that's why we've been demonstrating this week all across Canada against NATO, demanding Canada get out of NATO, demanding that NATO disband, and that there should not be a new arms race, which is being provoked by NATO, by sending all these arms into Ukraine, and to insist on countries like Canada upping its military spending to 2%. In Canada, it means a 70% increase in military spending. It's outrageous.
Well, we're looking again at what the U.S. President Joe Biden has said, Daniel Kovalik, in terms of pledging more military aid, in terms of more, things like warplanes and warships for Europe. $5 billion in U.S. aid, or maybe a little more than that, has been pledged during the Biden administration. But at the same time, we're seeing that Russia is not losing the war. Russia is going ahead with what it's doing, especially in the Donbas region. And it's interesting how NATO nor the U.S. are really even stating that Ukraine is actually being defeated. Why then is the U.S. first, then the NATO partner countries, sending more weapons and pledging more aid when Ukraine is being defeated? What does that say?
Well, we know why. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, about 6 weeks ago, I guess it was, made it very clear that the goal in Ukraine is to weaken Russia. That is to say, the U.S. will continue to support the war effort in Ukraine, regardless of whether Ukraine can win or not. They can't.
Well, tell us what you think he means when he says weaken Russia. You either weaken a country that's at war by either killing their soldiers or for that country to run out of ammunition. Which is it?
Well, I think they want to kill their soldiers They want to continue to have U.S. or Russia send soldiers to Ukraine and be killed. And yes, they want them to use up weaponry. They want their government to spend their revenue, of course, some of which the U.S. has stolen, on weapons and soldiers instead of on the economy and building up the economy and putting money into social programs. This is exactly the strategy that the U.S. openly, or at least after the fact, admitted, Brzezinski admitted openly later, that they used against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. The goal in Afghanistan in the 80s was to draw the Soviet Union into a war that would undermine and destroy the Soviet Union. In the words of Brzezinski, he wanted to give the Soviet Union its Vietnam, referring, of course, to the U.S. war in Vietnam, which was very destructive of the United States. And that's exactly what happened. And it did, in fact, help to weaken and ultimately destroy the Soviet Union. This is exactly the same game plan. They wanted this war. They provoked this war. Even the Pope has said that probably this war was provoked by the U.S. and NATO. They wanted to do that. They wanted Russia to intervene. And they want to extend this war as long as possible to undermine and, if they could, destroy Russia. And they don't care about Ukraine or the Ukrainians. They will fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. That is what is very clear.
Well, let's see here. Let's refer Ken Stone to what the U.S. National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, has said. And let me get your reaction on this, on your reading into this. He said that Zelensky wanted to pretty much secure an advantageous position in this conflict with Russia in months. By the end of the year, it turned out was what Zelensky was referring to, rather than years. That's coming from the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan. What does that say when Jake Sullivan makes that statement, when he says in months is what Zelensky wants rather than years, which is what the U.S. has in mind?
Well, like our Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, the U.S. Leaders have made it clear that what they want to achieve in Ukraine, as Dan Kovalik has correctly pointed out, is to defeat Russia. And Chrystia Freeland used the words vanquish Russia and defeat it. She said that while she was donating $500 million of Canadians' taxpayers' money to Ukraine. And in addition to that, they've sent several billion dollars worth of military equipment and other kinds of funding to Ukraine. And the purpose of this is to bring about the defeat of Russia. It's the opposite. It shows that the U.S. and NATO, Canada, and all the other NATO allies have an aggressive agenda here, and they're not about to look for peace with Russia. They've encouraged Mr. Zelensky and his government to continue fighting rather than bring about de-escalation, rather than fueling the conflict with arms and funding. And now Canadian Special Forces, according to the New York Times, are in Ukraine. And we were at the minister's office in Oakville yesterday, the defense minister's office, and she doesn't deny the fact that they're there. So they're there. And so Canada is de facto at war with Russia right now because we have boots on the ground in Ukraine. It's an aggressive war. What the opposite of all this would be, as the Russians argue, there should be a mutual security system in Europe such that the security of one state doesn't impinge upon the security of others. If all the states got together and achieved a collective or a mutual security system, we could have peace. But that's not on the agenda for the U.S. and NATO. This is clearly an aggressive move, an escalation, which brings us closer to the unthinkable, as your earlier report said. It brings us closer to a nuclear confrontation between nuclear powers. And that's something that could bring about the end, that would bring about the end of human civilization. So we should think, people across the world are thinking about the danger of this, and that's why people are in the streets, because they don't want this U.S. aggressive action in Ukraine and in Madrid to strengthen NATO to bring about the end of their lives and their children's lives.
Indeed. Well, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. Danny Kovala, Ken Stone talks about this unified security apparatus of some kind to be agreed upon, as Russia has proposed, so that there could be a mutual approach towards this conflict. But when you have Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, talk about how this war is going to end on the negotiating table, and at the same breath, he says only on the condition that Ukraine gets what it wants. I repeat, Ukraine gets what it wants, and that depends on the gains on the battlefield. How can you have a unified strategy of security when the other side is talking about what I just said?
This has never been about security. Not national security, not the security of the EU. Russia's never been a threat to the EU or to the United States. In fact, we have to be reminded that Putin was the first world leader to call George W. Bush after 9/11, offer condolences, offer help in the war on terror. Russia always wanted to work with the West. This is not about security. This is about the West's desire to create insecurity in Russia, to destroy Russia. That's what this is about. This has nothing to do with the EU protecting its own security. In fact, just the opposite. The sanctions have backfired on the EU. They are making the EU more insecure. They're going to be lucky if they can heat their homes come this winter.
Exactly. I'm going to have to jump in, unfortunately. Daniel Kovalik, we're just fresh out of time. I'm so sorry. Daniel Kovalik, the international human rights and labor lawyer. Thank you. From Pittsburgh, PA. Ken Stone, Canada, out of NATO. I see your pin. We got the message. Thank you. Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War from Hamilton, Ontario. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tahwe and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Taxing the excess profits of large corporations within the G7 alone could raise an estimated $430 billion to fight world hunger, deliver vaccine to entire world, and make a giant dent in the fight to drive down fossil fuel pollution and jumpstart the necessary renewable energy transition. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by John Quayle, journalist. This article is published under the heading Global Windfall Profit Tax of 90% Needed to Address Catastrophic Food and Climate Crises, Oxfam says. Stay tuned for more. With G7 leaders meeting in Germany for their annual summit, Oxfam International is demanding a global windfall profits tax on the massive financial gains made by large corporations over the last 2 years of COVID-19 pandemic, a tax that could fund major international initiatives to address the spiraling crises of hunger, poverty, and the climate emergency. With billions of people around the world struggling to afford food and millions facing acute hunger and famine-like conditions, the group said in a communique released recently that G7 leaders must drive straight into the unique and dire circumstances triggered by the pandemic, during which many major companies profited mightily to set out a properly funded plan that would tackle the food crisis and vaccine apartheid and provide people of developing nations the resources needed to fend off the worst impacts of a rapidly heating planet. New Oxfam research, the group says, shows that a 90% windfall tax on the excess profits made by G7's largest corporations during the pandemic could generate almost $430 billion. This money, the group argues, could fully fund the shortfalls on all existing humanitarian appeals and a 10-year plan to end hunger, while also raising enough for a one-off payment of over $3,000 to the poorest 10% of the population of the G7 countries to help cover the rising cost of living. According to Oxfam, the G7 need to double the amount of aid they provide for agriculture, food security, and nutrition, amounting to $15 billion per year. At the same time, they need to fully fund the $46 billion United Nations Global Humanitarian Appeal, which is only 21% funded today. Oxfam research shows that corporations in the energy, food, and pharmaceutical sectors, where monopolies are especially common, are posting record high profits, even as wages have barely budged and workers struggle with decades-high prices and COVID-19. The fortunes of food and energy billionaires have risen by $453 billion in the last 2 years, equivalent to $1 billion every 2 days. Five of the largest energy companies, including BP, Shell, Total Energies, Exxon, and Chevron, are together making the $2,600 profit every second. There are now 62 new food billionaires. The Ukraine-Russia crisis has had a huge impact on food prices, but these are fueled by long-standing inequalities and failures in the global food system. Equally, the COVID-19 pandemic and the climate crisis have deeply harmed the ability of poor people and poor nations to cope. Between April 2020 and December 2021, wheat prices had increased by 80%. In Munich recently, thousands marched to demand the G7 nations meet their obligations to the world. With fears growing of an already dire food crisis that experts warn will only intensify due to the ongoing crisis in Russia and Ukraine and climate-driven droughts that have pushed regions of Africa, the West Asia and South Asia into famine-like conditions, Oxfam warns that even the announcement from the G7 to forge a new global alliance for food security will not be enough. This global hunger crisis coming on top of the pandemic is catastrophic, said Gabriela Butcher, Oxfam International's executive director, recently. Butcher added, "The G7 have a chance to show ordinary people that they are on their side and not that of the corporates and creditors making huge excessive profits from these multiple crises." The G7 must implement a coordinated initiative of windfall taxes and debt cancellation to fully fund an action plan to end world hunger. Across all countries, as food and energy costs spiral, she said, it is the poorest and most marginalized people who are faced with the most desperate choices. Because hunger, just like the climate crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic, thrives on inaction, Butcher said world leaders must be ambitious with concrete initiatives, including the institution of the windfall tax on corporate profits. We know that large corporations are making very significant profits and have been making them during the pandemic, Butcher told The Guardian, as she singled out the fossil fuel industry as well as food giants and pharmaceutical companies. We have calculated how much excess profits there has been during the pandemic, and taxing excess profits as a windfall tax would generate resources both for the most affected populations in the richer countries, she said, adding, and to be able to fulfill commitments in terms of aid and responding to the worst suffering in the world.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English.